So Duncan Kenzie's subject is Turkey, Russia, and Israel. Well, good evening, everybody. It's nice to see you all. So I've done similar sort of presentations to this in the past, and this is going to follow a very similar format. So if you've heard some of the material, feel free to go out and get a coffee, and you don't even have to come back if you don't want. The main thrust of tonight's presentation is going to be to review some of the current events that are going on in the world. When it comes to Bible prophecy, we as a community believe that God rules in the kingdoms of men, and that is a key principle, and that's spelled out in Daniel's prophecies, Daniel chapter 4 and 5. So that we believe that God is setting things in motion for ultimately the return of his son, the Lord Jesus Christ, to this earth, which Jesus ascended up into heaven, as was described in the book of Acts, chapter 1, verse 11, and he promised that he would return in the same manner that he ascended into heaven. So we believe he will physically return to this earth at a set point in the future in the land of Israel, specifically in Jerusalem, to set up a kingdom to reign. Meanwhile, there's a lot of things that are going on in the world that are preparing for that to happen, and that's really where Bible prophecy comes in. Rather than try and give a specific interpretation to specific events that are happening, I think we're better served to look at sort of general trends that are happening in the world and see how they fit in with things that we kind of know must happen. So my belief from the reading that we read tonight in Zechariah 12 is that Israel and Jerusalem in particular is mentioned in verse 3, but Israel in general has to be essentially on its own without a friend in the world. And I've believed this for a long time, and basically the main supporter, practically the only supporter of Israel up until this point in time, has been the U.S. We are seeing a continuing decline of support for Israel in other parts of the world. There are some minor countries that really, you know, don't play a significant role in things that support them, but sort of in spirit only. For example, under the Harper government, Canada has been a very strong supporter of Israel. Under the Liberals, seems that the trend is continuing. Perhaps they're not quite so vociferously supportive of Israel as Harper's government was. Australia tends to be supportive of Israel. But if you look at Europe and you look at Great Britain and you look at other parts of the world, there is growing anti-Semitism. There is growing hatred of Israel. And you see, and not just terrorist attacks against Israelis throughout the world, but you see sort of anti-Semitism amongst the intelligentsia. It's almost very much like it was in the 1930s when the Jews were, no matter where they were kind of persecuted and hated. So I believe that Zechariah 12 is telling us this, that verse 3, on that day I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. All who lift it will surely hurt themselves, and all the nations of the earth will gather against it. And on that day, declares the Lord, I will strike every horse with panic and its rider with madness. But for the sake of the house of Judah, I will keep my eyes open when I strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. Then the clans of Judah shall say to themselves, the inhabitants of Jerusalem have strength through the Lord of hosts, their God. I also think that this is this is prophesied by Jesus, and we can see this in Matthew chapter 23, where Jesus says at the end of Matthew 23, where he has been talking to the scribes and the Pharisees, he's been criticizing them for their rejection of him, essentially. He says in verse 37, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to you, how often would I gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" Now, in John's Gospel and other places in Matthew's Gospel, Jesus says, "Do not make my Father's house a den of thieves." And that was primarily in reference to the temple that was in Jerusalem. And here in these verses, Jesus says, "Your house is left to you desolate." So Jerusalem, which was governed over politically and religiously by the priests and by the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes, has been handed over to them. It's no longer God's house, but it's their house, and it's going to be desolate. And we see that that's what happens shortly after Jesus dies in about 40 years later, in AD 70, Jerusalem is under siege by the Romans, and it is completely destroyed. And Matthew 24 talks in detail about this. So the key point here that Jesus says is that, "I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" And that's one of the reasons why I think that Jerusalem and Israel has to be left friendless, because they have to come to the point of repentance. They have to come to the point where they can't rely on their own strength, where they can't rely on the U.S. because the U.S. is no longer there. And so they say, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." They are really looking for Messiah. And at that point, they would be ready to, at least some of them would be ready to acknowledge the Lord Jesus Christ as their Messiah. So that's kind of the Bible framework that I think, as I understand it. We can also look at Ezekiel 38, which is an interesting chapter, which talks about a people's coming from the uttermost parts of the north to invade the land of Israel and to attempt to conquer Israel. And I'm not going to go into that chapter in great depth tonight, but I do think that the areas that we're looking at, the countries we're looking at, Turkey and Russia, fit that bill of being to the uttermost parts of the north. If you look on a map, and I've got a map as the last slide of this presentation, which shows that those countries are directly north of Israel. And Turkey and Russia are particularly important in what is happening for Israel right now. Now, we can't really talk about Turkey and Russia exclusively, because everything is so intertwined and linked together in the Middle East. And in fact, it's impacted by what's going on in Europe, what's going on in China, and what's going on in North Africa to some degree. But we're going to try and focus as much as we can on Turkey and Russia tonight and see what impact that has on Israel. And also look at Israel's relationship with Turkey and Russia specifically. And obviously what's going on in the United States is the other factor as to the impact on all these things. And that's probably one of the biggest impacts. Okay, we're going to start with a look at Turkey. So, as I mentioned, Turkey is directly to the north of Israel, And Turkey has a very interesting history. It started out at the turn of this century essentially as a secular society. It was it was the Ottoman Empire, and we're going to see a map that shows us where the Ottoman Empire extended to. And Turkey really came about as a country as a result of a guy named Ataturk. And he was a military leader. He was a secularist. So he was not a religious leader per se. He was not an Islamist. Currently, they have as their president an Islamist. And his name is Recep Tayyip Erdogan. It's not spelt like that in English, but that's kind of a rough pronunciation. And he is quite a militant Islamist. And I use the term Islamist as opposed to the term Muslim, because typically the term Islamist refers to radical Islam, refers to the kind of jihadist Islam movement that is typified by Al-Qaeda and ISIS or ISIL or IS, however you want to refer to them. We'll just call it IS, Islamic State. So he is very extreme in that he wants to establish again a caliphate in Turkey and make Turkey kind of the center of the Muslim world. He wants to essentially revive the Ottoman Empire and bring about Turkey's predominance in that region. And there's a lot of reasons why eventually, if things stay the same, continue as they have done since the fathers, then that in fact is what will happen, is that Turkey will become the predominant force in the Middle East. And mostly that's due to their geography as well as their population. They have a very high population. They have a very successful economic situation for the most part. So let's just look at the events in the recent past. And the recent past, I mean, as recently as July 16th. So what happened on July 16th, or July 15th, actually? Pardon?
Coup.
Yes, there was a coup. And how did that coup go? Not very well, poorly. It was a very, very poorly orchestrated affair. It was orchestrated by junior officers within the military, they believe, rather than the higher-ups. It seemed for a while that things were going pretty well, and Erdogan was, you know, out of the country, and they weren't going to let him back in. But it ended up being a complete debacle. And one of the commentators I read said, well, I'm going to write a book about this. It says How Not to Run a Coup, because it was so poorly done. So anybody know what Erdogan's response to this was?
Crackdown.
And what sorts of things did he do? Yeah, there was just a huge number. There were a huge number of people that he took care of. So he targeted the military, he targeted the judiciary, he targeted journalists, and he targeted academics, teachers. So all the intelligentsia, very much like Hitler did in the 1930s, as a prelude to what went on there, and as Stalin did in Russia. Okay? It was the same tactics. The other thing he did is he accused the U.S. of harboring the instigator of the coup from abroad. This is a fellow named Fethullah Gulen, who lives somewhere in Philadelphia, and he and Erdogan used to be best friends. But then they ran against each other in politics about 3 or 4 years ago, and since then they've been enemies. So this is what somebody writes about this, the purge. And this is kind of as it was happening, was Erdogan's purge will be severe. He declared that the coup attempt was a gift from God, because this will be a reason to cleanse our army in a victory speech on July 17th. Turkish security forces immediately arrested over 6,000 soldiers, dozens of colonels, and four high-ranking officers as they reestablished control. The purge has removed approximately one-third of all general officers. He will try the coup leaders and participating rank-and-file soldiers for treason and approve the reinstitution of the death penalty if passed by the Turkish parliament. He will eliminate political rivals and dissenters and consolidate social control. He is already using the allegation against Gulen to justify a broad crackdown against the judicial establishment, including the arrest, dismissal and arrest of nearly 3,000 members of the judicial establishment. He's dismissed 8,000 police. His consolidation phase will require significant time, but he'll continue to do it. Meanwhile, he must balance national security concerns, including an unreliable military, domestic threats from IS, and the Kurds, the PKK, Kurdistan Workers' Party, as well as a tenuous detente with Russia. Now, there has been some ideas that he actually staged this coup to consolidate power, which is an interesting theory. George Friedman, who, if you've heard me in the past, you'll know that I'm a big fan of George Friedman. He used to be the head of Stratfor, which is an intelligence publication. They publish news. Well, it's not really news. It's analysis about what's going on in the world. And he left Stratfor a while ago and started another one called Geopolitical Futures. So I'm now subscribing to that one as well. And George Friedman makes predictions about what's going to happen in the next 100 years. And he's also made predictions about what's going to happen in the next 25 years. And he says by 2040, Turkey will be the predominant power in the Middle East. And he lists all kinds of reasons for that. Anyway, he says many observers have asked whether the coup attempt was real or staged to justify a state of emergency. It's an interesting question. Whether the coup was genuine or not, the crucial fact is that a dictatorship has emerged and imposed a state of emergency. He has conducted a massive purge of opponents, arrested tens of thousands. The focus has been on his natural enemy, though, the military. All parts of Turkish society are being transformed by culling those who Erdogan doesn't trust or who have strongly opposed him. The state of emergency legally lasts for 3 months but can be extended, or new laws can be passed to justify continuing the dictatorship. But by the time it's all done, if it is effective, dictatorship will not be needed as Erdogan will have broken his opposition. So that's what he some of the things that he says. Now, interestingly, as we go back through the history of what happened since July 16th, we start to get the Turks taking a more active role in Syria, and for the very first time, they have actually invaded Syria since all the stuff has been going on in Syria, ostensibly to conquer IS and to help repel IS from some of the territory that they hold. On August the 29th, this is what was said by a presidential envoy for the coalition. The United States on Monday criticized clashes between Turkish forces and some opposition groups in northern Syria as unacceptable, calling on all armed actors in the fighting to stand down and focus on battling IS. We want to make it clear that we find these clashes in areas where IS is not located unacceptable and a source of deep concern, Brett McGurk, the special presidential envoy for the Coalition to Counter IS, said on his official Twitter account, citing a Defense Department statement. Why is the United States criticizing Turkey for their involvement in Syria? Anybody know?
Because they're fighting against some of the forces that the U.S. is supporting.
Exactly. They're fighting against the Kurds. And the Kurds who occupy territory in Syria, Iraq, and Turkey, or are present in those areas, they don't really occupy the territory, they live in those places, have wanted an independent nation for a long time, and the Kurds are responsible for some terrorist acts, as they're described, in Turkey. And so Erdogan is more concerned about actually suppressing the Kurds under the guise of suppressing IS than he is in doing that. So that's quite interesting. That brings us to today. What do you think about that picture? This is today. Well, one thing is that Angela Merkel is wearing her usual pantsuit outfit. That's a nice sort of pale blue. I've seen her in a green, and I've seen her in a pink. You know, it's sort of her trademark outfit. What else do you notice? Putin is talking to the Turkish. He's talking to Erdogan. And what's this guy over here doing?
Looking at
him. This is a classic pose, I think. It's like, yeah. He's on one side of the room, and Turkey and Russia are on the other side of the room. Okay? Now, if that wasn't enough, what you're going to hear next is hilarious. And this is on the New York Times website. And the New York Times is a left-wing publication that is highly supportive of Obama. Okay? It is not Fox News. It's not the National Post. Okay? It's right up there with the Toronto Star and the Globe and Mail. Sorry, just kidding. On the Globe and Mail part. The Toronto Star part is correct. So here's what happened today. President Obama sought on Sunday to heal a rift with Turkey, expressing his wholehearted support for its president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, in the wake of a failed effort to oust him, and promising America's help in bringing the coup plotters to justice. So the guy had said that, you know, America's harboring this guy who plotted the coup. And now Obama's promising to help. Mr. Obama's comments after he met with Erdogan before a Group of 20 summit meeting here seemed calculated to smooth over hard feelings in Turkey, where some officials had blamed the United States for fomenting the July 15th uprising by elements of the military. These are the same officials that are accusing the EU of fomenting the coup, of accusing the EU of being racist because they criticized Turkey for having laws that make it okay to have sex with children 15 years and younger. That it's legal and they don't. So the reaction in Turkey was, you're racist, when the members, people in Australia, I mean in the Austrian government, came up and argued against that and said this is completely wrong. And the Swedish foreign minister said this is completely wrong. And this was Turkey's response, is to say, oh, you guys just fomented the coup. Mr. Malaprop. He said nothing about, this is Obama again, he said nothing about Erdogan's crackdown after the coup in which tens of thousands of people were arrested and his reference to helping Turkey bring the perpetrators of the uprising to justice was not accidental. Erdogan is demanding that the United States extradite Gulen, a Turkish Muslim cleric living in Pennsylvania, whom he accused of inciting the coup. This is the first opportunity that I've had to meet face-to-face with Erdogan since the terrible attempted coup, Mr. Obama said, facing the Turkish leader across a long table. We're glad you're here, safe, and that we are able to continue to work together. He papered over the fact that Turkey's interests have diverged recently from those of the United States, particularly in Syria. Just 6 days ago, the United States was criticizing him, where Turkish forces have intervened to prevent Syrian Kurds from making further gains in the northern part of the country. And then the other thing that Obama said at this summit, Obama, speaking at the G20 summit in China, praised the Turkish people who had resisted the coup attempt, saying they affirmed their commitment to democracy and that they are the strength and brilliance of democratic institutions. This was the reception that Joe Biden got when he went to Turkey a few weeks ago, shortly after the coup. You can see from the body language here and from the facial expressions that Erdogan was not pleased. And in fact, as Biden was there visiting with him, Erdogan went in and invaded in Syria to specifically attack the Kurds. So, as somebody else wrote, what we fail to understand is that while the U.S. is trying to use these proxy nations to fight its wars for them, their goals, their needs are to crush other forces or other elements that they see as opposing them besides IS are much greater than the U.S.'s perceived need to take care of IS. So while we're all focused on the Islamic State and we think they are the worst thing in the world, Erdogan thinks the Kurds are the worst thing in the world. And they are a much higher priority to him than IS. So the situation is very, very complex, okay, because of this. Okay, let's see, what do we have next? Oh, yeah, so here's the slide with the resurgence of the Ottoman Empire. And oh, you can't see that very well. The colors don't come out very well. But essentially, these dark areas were all the original areas of the Ottoman Empire, the darker areas. Any questions about that? I'm getting some funny laughs. What are you laughing at? Well, this is supposed to be green, but it shows green on my computer. Do you want to look at my laptop? but you can see the dark area. That was the Ottoman Empire until when? Anybody know when the Ottoman Empire ended? Pardon? Let's ask Tom, because I think he was around then. Jack was around in 1917, maybe. towards the end of World War I, right? This is when the Sykes-Picot Agreement was drawn up, which was an agreement between a British bureaucrat and a French bureaucrat. Can you imagine any worse possible agreement? Two bureaucrats, and one's British and one's French. And neither of them knew what they were doing. So they came up and they said, okay, we're gonna redraw the lines on the map. And so when they did that, they essentially gave Iraq to the Hashemites, and they gave Jordan, which didn't exist before then. It was originally called Transjordan. They gave that to the Hashemites, and then they gave Saudi Arabia to the Saudis. So basically what had happened is they had had some Arabic tribes that had cooperated with them, and this is where Lawrence of Arabia came to play a major role in things. And those tribes fought alongside the British and the French to push back the Turks. And so once that happened, then Lebanon and came into being. That was a French country or territory that they got, and they named it Lebanon, which is some French word for something or other, maybe duck soup, I don't know. And then Israel, or Palestine, before it became called Israel in 1948, that was liberated and became a British protectorate. And then we get, 1 year later, we get the Balfour Declaration, right? So that was the end of the Ottoman Empire. Turkey had to retreat back to just basically the areas that it's in today, in Turkey. And it lost a tremendous amount of territory. You can see it had all of Egypt, all that land. So it was a big empire. Well, now what we see is with the resurgence of Turkey, their goals are to try and get back that Ottoman Empire. And who were some of their biggest sort of competitors, would you guess, would be some of their biggest competitors?
Iran?
Definitely. Iran would be one of them. Iran's not marked on that map, is it?
Or it's over. That's it. Well, the blank area.
The blank area?
Yeah. Beside it.
Beside Turkey. To the
yeah,
right of Turkey?
The Ottoman Empire.
Right. Right. So this area over here you're saying is Iran?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. And then Iraq. I'm always surprised at how big Iran is relative to Iraq, right? Iraq's just a little area. Right, Bob?
Yeah.
So, they're a big competitor with Turkey. And then Saudi Arabia is another competitor. Now, the Saudis and the Turks are both Sunni Muslims. One's Arab and one isn't. Whereas the Iranians are Shiites, and that's why they're propping up Assad's regime in Syria, because Assad is essentially he's an Alawite, but they're basically like the Shiites. Okay, so this is still that Sunni-Shiite conflict that's going on. Okay, so let's move on and let's talk about Russia. So Russia and Turkey have a very sort of complex relationship as well. Okay, we've seen how the U.S. is trying to work with Turkey because they want Turkey to use their forces to attack IS, but Turkey kind of has its own agenda that they're following. So there's this push and pull between the two of them. And we can see from Obama's remarks today that he's trying to mollify the Turks. He doesn't want to lose their support totally. Now, the Turks actually can't afford to lose the United States support either, because militarily there's too much at stake for them, as well as economically, and they need that cooperation. The same thing is true between Turkey and Germany with the issue of the refugees, that there's push and pull there with the relationship. But Russia also has the same complex relationship. Now, does anybody remember what happened a little while ago between Russia and Turkey that was a big deal? Yeah, the downing of the aircraft. And what happened there, Jack? Do you remember? Yeah, so the plane had taken off, I think, from their base in the Mediterranean, and it was trying to attack in Syria, but it wandered into Turkish airspace. It wasn't there very long. It might have been there 30 seconds, maybe a minute. And rather than Turkey just letting it go and go back into Syria, they downed it. Now, from the Turks' point of view, this wasn't the first time this had happened. So they were saying, hey, you know, you've done it once already. Another time, we're just going to down it. So Russia was furious about this, or Putin was furious about it. And so he said, you know, we're going to impose sanctions on you, and we're cutting you off. And Turkey was like, oh, okay, go ahead and do that. Well, that didn't work for either of them, really. So recently, they've kissed and made up, and Erdogan actually wrote a letter which was an apology to Russia for the downing. And he'd said that he would never do that, but in fact, he went ahead and he did it. And meanwhile, Russia really needs Turkey's cooperation because of what they're trying to accomplish in Syria, and because Russia is in a bad way economically. George Friedman believes that Putin has 2 years to turn things around in Russia, and if he doesn't, then Russia is going to collapse as a federation. So that'll be interesting to see. A lot of his predictions have come true. So if we're looking at the collapse of Russia, he says, watch out, because they will be a serious threat. If they're going into that kind of decline, then they're going to take drastic measures to turn things around. So, this is the other thing that happened just today. Turkey drove out ISIS in that area. But let's just take a look at this. This is a map. Oh, the colors look a bit better on this one. You'd be happy to see. So this is Russia here on the right, and this is Eastern Europe. Okay, so this was kind of pretty much the area that used to be behind the Iron Curtain until the fall of communism in 1990 or whenever that happened. I think it was 1990, wasn't it? The end of the Soviet Union. So this is the buffer that Russia has always had from Western Europe. And the thing about Russia is that it has no natural defense lines. Okay? So it just has this land border, which is vast and is hard to defend. And this is part of the problem in World War II. It ended up bogging down the Germans, but it was just as destructive for the Russians as the battle went on, because unlike the United States, which has water on all three sides, and it just has us guys up in the north, the United States is much better protected because it's got a lot of ocean around it, whereas Russia doesn't. So the geographical problem can be seen from the map here. Europe is divided between the peninsula, surrounded by the Baltic Sea, the North Sea, the Atlantic, and the Mediterranean, and its adjacent sea, the Black Sea. The base of this peninsula runs from St. Petersburg, which is up here, down to Rostov-on-Don. That line is roughly coterminous with the eastern borders of the Baltic states, Belarus, and Ukraine, which act as buffers between Russia and Europe. Russia is militarily difficult to defend if all three of these regions are hostile. It lacks strategic depth as well as any natural barriers on which to base a defense. So that is part of the issue for Russia. The other issue is that they are suffering from the effects of declining oil prices. Also that, interestingly, the Saudis are also suffering from it. The Saudis have had to cut back the income that they pay to the ruling royal family. So they are really starting to feel severe impact from declining or the crash. in oil prices. That's kind of an aside, but Saudi Arabia is also another place where we can look to see instability going on, and that there's going to be changes there. But Russia in particular is really finding it a struggle. The revenue from this commodity has been used to sustain internal cohesion. And what that means is that Moscow has been feeding out all the revenue from oil to the provinces to try and keep them happy. And that's not a good economic model. You really want the provinces feeding you guys, you know, feeding the center of the city, feeding Russia, instead of the other way around. So with this revenue now severely drained, Russia will devolve into a confederation or even fragment into secessionist parts by 2040. The future of Russian nuclear weapons will become a crucial strategic issue as this devolution takes place. Okay? So Russia is, as George Friedman describes it, they're on a precipice. He says, until 2014, Russia seemed to be doing well. Beneath the surface, however, things were not going that well. Economically, Putin had failed to use oil revenue when prices were high to build a real economy. Strategically, Russia's intelligence and military capacity was not even close to what it had been. But Putin pointed to Russia's income, Europe's fear of a gas cutoff, and Russia's victory in Georgia as signs of success. Success, however tenuous, creates the illusion of prosperity. It is now 2016, and the elite, and increasingly the public, are realizing the economy is not going to recover. They see that slowing the economic decline is the best they can hope for. They also realize that Ukraine has not been secured. So for all they went into Ukraine is still a challenge for them. And that the grand foray into Syria is achieving what all grand forays into the Middle East achieve, stalemate. Okay. So it's pretty serious for Putin. There's a number of other things that are going on there, too. Putin comes from the FSB, which is the successor to the KGB. And he's basically, for all his personal magnetism and his persona, he's actually kind of a puppet of all his peers at the FSB. And if things start to go downhill, they could turn on him and he could be replaced. And then who knows what Russia will be like in those circumstances. So Russia is highly unstable. Okay. Now this is just a picture of showing. I think we've all probably seen this picture a long time ago, right? But it still tells a good story of, there was going to be a reset in relations when Obama came on the scene between him and Putin. He was going to fix what W had messed up. Well, we can see from this picture exactly what the nature of their relationship is, and it really is emblematic of what the nature of their relationship is. And so what is the problem with the United States? Any idea? Pardon? Well, what is Obama's strategy? What's his approach to problems? To get through without a war, okay. Does he have any other long-term strategies than that? Maybe he wants to top up his RRSPs.
I was going to say improve social programs in the States.
Yeah. So, essentially, His model for foreign policy, and it will likely be the model for his successor, whether it's Trump or Mrs. Clinton, is that the United States has experienced a long period of very expensive wars, a huge loss of blood and treasure with very little to show for it. They are tired of being the world's policemen. They are tired of being beaten up by people who criticize them when they go in and try and do things. They've learned hard lessons from their failure in Iraq. Iraq is still a disaster. Instead of being an occupying force, they should have gone in and set up a government, worked to set up a government, but that didn't happen, and whether that was even possible anyway is another question. So they are basically reverting to, it's been called isolationism, but I don't really think that's a fair description. It's more, we're just going to try and support with minimal cost, either in terms of money or people, the states that exist immediately in the zone of conflict and try and get them to take care of the issues for us. So as we've already seen, the problem with that strategy is when you have a goal that is in conflict with the goal of the nations involved, it's hard to accomplish that. So with Turkey's primary concern is with the Kurds, whereas the United States' primary concern is it's not any longer with Assad. Assad's kind of out the question. He's, in fact, probably the U.S. and Russia have a gentleman's agreement to keep things going in Syria, to keep the warfare going, because nobody wants to see a vacuum of power, and so they don't want to see Assad removed, ironically. They don't want to see him win, but they don't want to see him removed. That sounds incredibly cynical, doesn't it? But if you ever read any of John le Carré's books, I think that cynicism is well-founded. That's the way politics works. And I think you can see that in the way Obama has responded today to the Turkish leader. It's kind of scary, it's kind of sad to think that people's lives are being sacrificed to keep a conflict going, because the alternative is you create a vacuum and you create uncertainty. It seems morally wrong, and it probably is morally wrong, but that's the kind of thing that happens. But meanwhile, Turkey has one goal and the U.S. has another goal. So we're kind of running out of time, so I'll just get to the Israel part of it. So here we have Turkey shifting again in how it's dealing with Israel. What happened between Turkey and Israel a few years ago? Anybody remember that incident, major incident that happened? I think it happened 4 years ago. I think there were 9 people killed. Yeah, and they were activists and, you know, left-wing tree huggers. No, they were people who were pro-Palestinian. And Erdogan himself actually organized the trip and set it up. It was a setup for the Israelis where they really couldn't win no matter what happened, even though they were ostensibly friends. So after that happened, Erdogan demanded an apology, which he got one from Netanyahu. He apologized. And then they've arranged to actually financially, the Israelis are financially compensating the families involved. And so eventually, ties have been restored between the two nations. And just recently, they formally put an end to the enmity, and Erdogan said, we're going to open our embassies again, and we're going to be best friends again. So Turkey is taking on Israel as a friend. Now, the interesting thing that The Jerusalem Post has to say, Geopolitical Futures has to say this. Reaching an accommodation with Israel, that is Turkey reaching an accommodation with Israel, is risky. Jihadists will see it as a further sign of betrayal because Hamas has been supported by Turkey. So Hamas is in the Gaza Strip and parts of the West Bank, and they are Shiite. Hezbollah in the south of Lebanon is, no, sorry, they're Sunni. They're Sunni. Hezbollah in Lebanon is Shiite. And they've sort of been in competition with one another, not real enemies, but kind of enemies. So this says that jihadists, like Hamas, will see it as a further sign of betrayal, which could result in more terrorist bombings in Turkey. But given Turkey's isolation in the region, it needed U.S. support, and the U.S. wanted Turkey and Israel operating together. So this is suggesting that the reason for the detente is because the U.S. wanted it. The Turks needed some cover so they will be able to get supplies to Gaza and call it a weakening of Israel's blockade. The economic and strategic benefits to Israel are substantial. But this agreement left the Turks with a hostile Russia. As I said, the U.S. didn't mind this, but the Turks apparently did. They saw themselves locked into the American alliance with Israel and an anti-Russian alliance with Poland. If they allowed this to continue, they would wind up in pretty much the same position as they were in during the Cold War, a pawn of U.S. policy. So Turkey coupled the agreement with Israel with an apology to Russia. Recep Tayyip Erdogan does not like to apologize, and the Turkish public will see it as a capitulation. But the alternative would be to lose all room for maneuver in the region. The apology to Russia opens the door for cooperation, but it doesn't mean that it will happen. It tells the U.S. not to take Turkey for granted. The Israelis, it should be noted, have been flirting with the Russians for several months, and the Russians would like to be portrayed as the peacemakers. Obviously, the Israelis had discussed Turkey with them, but Israel must have an outside patron, and Russia does not have the depth and stability to provide Israel with what it needs. Still, keeping the U.S. off balance is necessary for any ally. Now, that's supposedly an objective understanding of events. So what we get out of that is we've got this strained alliance with Russia and Turkey, a strained alliance with Turkey and Israel, and a potential alliance with Russia and Israel. Now, I think this is the first time in my memory that I can think of Russia playing a more prominent role than the U.S. in terms of a relationship with Israel, at least, you know, appearance-wise. Can anybody else think of when that might have happened? I can't. And it's just amazing that it's happened. An article on the National Post, which is talking about Turkey's move against the U.S.-backed Kurdish forces, which we've already said, you know, the U.S. was opposed to, says this official in the Israeli government says, "The will of the United States of America has rarely carried less weight than it does now in regional affairs," he said. "And that means that those of us who worry about regional stability have to work together for ourselves." It says, "Regional ties are much more important to us than they used to be in the past." He said, "When our traditional geostrategic policy used to be, let's talk to Washington about it, that was the mainstay of our strategy, but that assumption can no longer be made." He He said, either because the U.S. does not want to get involved or is unable anymore to make things happen. I think the Prime Minister is acutely aware of that. This is the Prime Minister of Israel. And it is fueling efforts, you see, to find other ways of communicating with our immediate environment. Translation, let's get the Russians involved. Lerman stresses that the U.S. is still powerful compared to all the other powers in the region, and that's absolutely true. The U.S. is still the most powerful nation in the world. But it can make a difference if it wants to make a difference. But for the time being, we are seeing in the Turkish incursion a reflection of this reduced profile. So the policies of Obama in stepping back have had this unintended consequence of saying to the rest of the world that the U.S. is weak and disinterested. It may not, in fact, be the case, but that's how everybody perceives it. And since every time anything that they do to challenge the U.S. doesn't come back and do anything, and you get these kind of ridiculous statements like you've heard today from Obama, that just reinforces that notion. Okay, one final thing, and then we'll close. A senior official in the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, said this week he believes that Russia would be a more balanced and credible mediator in Israeli-Palestinian peace talks than the United States. Russia can fulfill a positive, credible, and more balanced role, he said, since the U.S. is not at all interested in pressuring Israel, which is carrying out its policy in the region. That's okay. That's typical, right? The Palestinians will say that the U.S. is just supporting what Israel wants to do and not do anything about it. But this part of it is interesting. Israeli and Palestinian sources earlier this week had confirmed reports of the possibility of a meeting in Moscow between Netanyahu and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas after Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi said that Putin had offered to host direct negotiations. So it's all very interesting. A lot of information there, very complex, lots of moving parts, kind of confusing. Before we close, I'll ask, are there any questions about what I presented? This was
not a question, Duncan, but just another statement from the Palestinian Liberation Organization and Abbas. Apparently, they've been undergoing elections in the last few days, and it looks like that Fatah, that part of the Liberation Organization, now are going to have a fair majority over the Hamas in the Gaza Strip. So there's, again, there's going to be a lot of instability.
Oh, really? I hadn't seen anything about that. That's interesting. Huh. There's absolutely no way that Turkey is going to join the EU.
No.
There's no chance.
I don't see it either.
No.
But,
that opportunity has been and gone.
And Turkey is basically the Togarmah and Gomorrah that we see in Ezekiel 38.
Mm-hmm.
Territorial
Yep. Yeah. It's pretty interesting. Any other observations or questions? I hope that all made sense. It's a bit more complex than some of the stuff I've done in the past, just because of all the moving parts. But okay. Thanks. The bottom line is, Jesus wins. If you ever want to know how to expound Revelation, that's Revelation according to John Launchbury. God wins. So.